You're listening to the Operational Maritime Law Podcast, presented by the NATO Center of Excellence for Operations in Confined and Shallow Waters, headquartered in Kiel, Germany. To learn more, please visit coecsw.org.
Lieutenant Commander Heidi Strarup joined the Canadian Armed Forces in 2002 as a port inspection diver. She received her Bachelor of Arts degree from the University of Victoria in 2005, following the completion of her Juris Doctorate degree at the University of Ottawa in 2014 and subsequent call to the bar in British Columbia in 2015. She then transferred to the Office of the Judge Advocate General. She's currently a Deputy Judge Advocate at the Assistant Judge Advocate General Pacific Office in Victoria, British Columbia. She is the legal advisor to the Joint Task Force Pacific and advises on all domestic operations within the region. She deployed to Kuwait in 2020 as the legal advisor for Op Impact, which is Canada's contribution to the Middle East Stabilization Force, and participated as a legal advisor for RIMPAC in 2022. Heidi, good morning to you in Victoria. Is that right?
Yes, that's right, James. Good morning.
Nice. I have not been back in a couple of years, but I definitely call the Pac Northwest home. Well, actually, do you call it Pac Northwest, Pac Southwest for Canadians, right?
Pacific Northwest.
Do you have a nickname for it? Really? All right. Speaking the same language, off to a good start. I'll also say this is the first time we are meeting and talking in person, well, virtually, but in person. So it is also a pleasure to finally meet you.
You as well.
We've known each other for about a year now in the CC lines of other people's emails.
Yeah.
I think how most relationships start. But in the exchange of those emails, I happened to receive your bio for a conference that we are organizing, or that we organize here at the COECSW every year, called the Conference on Operational Maritime Law, and came across your bio for that and thought, ooh, this is an interesting person I would like to talk to and get to interview. That being said, first question that probably popped out to some listeners was port inspection diver. That's I'm guessing that's not the typical starting point for most JAGs in the Canadian Armed Forces. Is that wrong?
You are correct. I think I'm the one and only former port inspection diver in the OJAG.
First and the best. So that prompts me to ask you, though, what prompted you to join as a port inspection diver in the first place? And then what led you to join leave that glamorous life for the law?
Well, I got to say, it was a complete fluke that I joined the military. The day I joined, I didn't even know that the Naval Reserves existed. So I received a call from one of my good friends, and she said her uncle was in town and that he was in the Navy and asked if I wanted to come for a tour of the Navy base. And I was said, sure, why not? That sounds interesting. Turns out he was a recruiting officer and started telling us about some of the benefits of joining the reserves, such as they'll pay for half of your university, there's full-time employment opportunities or part-time during school. So at the time, I was a first-year university student at the University of Victoria, and working for minimum wage at Gold's Gym. So certainly looking for something a little more interesting. So we both signed up right on the spot, pretty much. And a couple months later, off to boot camp we went, and then off to our initial dive course. And the only reason I signed up as a diver is because my friend had just come back from backpacking in Australia and received her dive certification. And she was just like, I love it. It's awesome. We got to do this. Let's be divers. And I was like, okay, well, that sounds interesting. So you didn't need any prior diving experience to become a port inspection diver. So I ticked off the box to be a diver, and well, the rest is history, I guess.
That is terrific. Yeah. I mean, they'll tell you, they'll train you to do anything, right?
Absolutely.
That's so fun. And so then you did that for some time and then became a lawyer. How does that work? What's that transition like? And why did you do it?
Right. So I spent 14 years as a port inspection diver. So throughout my undergrad, I worked part-time through university, and then I would work full-time at either fleet diving unit. We have two fleet diving units in Canada, one on the Atlantic, one on the Pacific. And so I would work full-time throughout my studies. And then when I finished my undergrad, I actually went and worked full-time at the Fleet Diving Unit Pacific. I really enjoyed the work and kind of transitioned as a reservist. I had the flexibility to work a couple years, take some time off, travel, come back. So I did that for about 6 years and then kind of got the itch to go back to school, kind of feeling like I should do something with my bachelor's degree because it certainly wasn't required to be a port inspection diver. So it's actually my sister who convinced me to go to law because she's a lawyer. And once I kind of was looking at various professional degrees, she's like, well, if you like to study, then being a lawyer is basically like being a full-time student. So I was like, you know what? You're right. Okay. So I ended up applying to law school and was successful in getting in. But right from the get-go of law school, I had my eyes set on joining the office of the JAG. I knew that we had full-time military lawyers and reserve lawyers as well. So I was able to get in touch with a number of lawyers who were current serving members and just kind of got a sense of what the job was like and what it took to apply. So I found out that you had to be called to the bar. So I had a finished law school article and then was able to apply as a regular force member with the office of the JAG. So I article with a civilian company or law firm rather in Victoria. And then was able to put in my application.
That's really fascinating. And I wonder, well, first, can you just say what JAG is and what is a JAG Corps?
Right. So I belong to the Office of the Judge Advocate General. So the Judge Advocate General is obviously in charge of all the league ads within the Canadian Armed Forces. So we work for the Office of the Judge Advocate General.
Yeah, that makes sense. I say that because the U.S. has the same acronym. We say JAG as well, but some other militaries don't necessarily do. So I want to clarify that for everyone.
Right.
And then, so we know kind of why you wanted to join or become a lawyer, but the JAG Corps in particular, did you have any prior experience or interaction with them as a diver or in your prior service?
So not as a diver, but only through sort of friends in the military. You know, the longer you spend in the Canadian Armed Forces, the smaller it becomes. And I'm sure it's similar for you. So I was able to kind of just ask, you know, hey, do you know anybody in the branch? And was able to connect with a few lawyers who really kind of gave me some insight what the day-to-day life was and, you know, was very intrigued. But I really like just working for the military, the environment, and I especially knew that once I articled for a civilian firm, and I knew that was not the path that I wanted to go. So when I actually finished my articles, I'd put my application in, but it hadn't gone through yet. So I actually came back to the Fleet Diving Unit and was working full-time as a diver while being a fully qualified lawyer.
Oh, wow.
And waited for my interview very impatiently.
That's kind of cool they could do that, though.
Yeah, that's, well, beauty of the reserves. You have a bit of flexibility there. So,
yeah.
And then fortunately, I got the call and was selected to join the OJAG. So, but the interesting part was once I got picked up, I actually immediately joined the Assistant Judge Advocate General Pacific Office, which is the regional service office in Victoria. And it's the same location as the Fleet Diving Unit Pacific. So once I was able to transfer, I literally went one day from coveralls and steel-toed boots to a white collared shirt and shiny shoes. And
right across
it
the
was
pier.
Changed the epaulets and yeah, from P2 to lieutenant. It was kind of a seamless, kind of surreal experience for sure.
Wow, that's so interesting. I will preface this question by saying another motivator for having you on the show is that I have, since January, basically any place people will allow me, events that I go to, I've been issuing surveys to try and help understand how we can make the COE, CSW more effective, our activities and projects more relevant to our customers. And I always squeeze in a question there that says, if you were going to hear an Operational Maritime Law podcast, what's some of the content you'd be interested in? And a lot of people who have taken the survey say, I want to know about other JAG's life. You know, what's the legal advisor's life like in a different nation service? And so with that being said, would you mind giving just a brief overview of what the normal process is for, you know, if people don't want to become a diver first, what's the process they would have to go through to join the JAG Corps in the Canadian Armed Forces?
Right. So we essentially have two avenues. So we have direct entry officers. So you can join off the street. So you just have to be a qualified lawyer. So essentially you have to be called to the bar and a member in good standing of a provincial or territorial bar association. You have to be a Canadian citizen. So sorry for any of you. international folks. You also have to, once you're selected, you have to be bilingual in both French and English. So that was certainly a challenge for myself because I was not bilingual in French, but I've worked hard to try and develop that skill.
See, you love studying.
I do. Yes, it never ends.
So it all worked out.
Yeah.
I'm curious. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, sorry. I was just going to say, and you know, once you're selected, obviously you have to complete your boot camp, just like any other general service officer. So you would do your basic military officer qualification, before you come over to our branch. So you have to get through that first, and then you would come to one of our offices and start kind of your on-job training, and then eventually do your legal officer qualification course. So for direct entry, everybody has to do that, but we also have a military legal officer training program. So it's open to anybody who's already in the regular force, of the Canadian Armed Forces, and they can actually apply to, get put through law school, and join the branch that way as well. So we pick up roughly 4 or 5 candidates a year from, Army, Air Force, Navy who come and join the branch.
So, oh, wow. What a cool opportunity.
And we are unique in that aspect is that we're considered a purple trade. So you can join I could have switched uniform, been an Army officer, Air Force, or Navy. Within our branch, it doesn't matter. We serve all three different elements. And so you can deploy with Army, Air Force, Navy, despite the uniform you wear. So.
So, I mean, that's a really good segue too, because the next question I wanted to ask you was about the training. So, I mean, not you in particular, because I already know the answer, but in general, if you were a lawyer with the Canadian Armed Forces, as part of your pipeline, would you receive any kind of specialized maritime law training, or would you have to kind of seek that out if you wanted to go that route?
I would say most people seek it out. There's elements of it taught in our legal officer qualification course in the operational law portion of that, but it's very limited in what you would actually learn and kind of fairly general. But a number of our lawyers who have a keen interest in maritime law will go on to do their master's in law and in that field. So it is certainly an avenue that certain lawyers decide to seek, and others have more of an interest in, say, criminal law, and will do their master's in criminal law. So, but for maritime law, there are a number of lawyers who have quite specific education to enable them to kind of be specialists in that area.
Yeah, and I wonder too, will this seeking that extra education out qualify people to hold different billets or kind of direct their own career path, if you will?
I think it can help because we have what we call the three pillars. We have operational law, military justice, and administrative law. So if you wanted to specialize in something related to maritime law, you would kind of try and focus your efforts to working in the operational law realm. And certainly there would be certain clients that it might help to have that maritime background, but, I guess the short answer is not necessarily. You could certainly end up advising. I don't have a master's in law in maritime law, but I currently advise naval units. So,
and we love operational law here on the Operational Maritime Law Podcast. So we'll get a little bit into that. One of your deployments, operational deployment, Op Impact. Can you tell us what was Op Impact and what was the role of the LEGAD in that?
Right. So Op Impact started back in 2014, and that began as Canada's contribution to the global coalition against Daesh. So as the years have gone on, that mission's changed somewhat. And so in 2020, when I deployed, we were really focused more on the capacity building side. So we had a number of teams that were involved in essentially training forces in Iraq, Lebanon, Jordan. And the intent there is to try and, you know, increase the stability of their forces and also, you know, ultimately those countries as well. So for myself, I was the legal advisor to JTF. Which is Joint Task Force Impact.
Okay. And what does being a legal advisor for an operation like that typically entail? What's kind of the normal day-to-day, or what are some of the issues that you'd encounter in that line of work?
Right. So I was the legal advisor to the commander and his staff. So I advise on various aspects of international law, but it was anything from rules of engagement to disciplinary matters to claims against the crown or for the crown, some contracts, land use agreements, and status of force agreements as well. So.
Yeah, I think I'm sure a lot of the other legal advisors that are listening can relate. But I do want to ask a question about, go back to training for a second. Was there anything that you were not trained on prior to that where you thought, ooh, I wish I had a little bit more expertise in this thing? And it doesn't have, you don't have to say operational maritime law, but.
Admittedly, there was not a lot of maritime law in Kuwait.
Oh, shucks.
I know. I'm sorry. It's not really the operation isn't really that relevant necessarily to the subject matter.
No. Well, like you said, though, what's fascinating is as a naval officer, you can get thrown into any number of scenarios. I was talking recently to a French Air Force officer whose first deployment was on a ship. You know what I mean? So
right.
I always try to hammer home the point to people, you know, just because it's not relevant to you right now doesn't mean that it won't be. And I think a lot of the principles are probably the same too. What's your role as the legal advisor when you're advising a commander? How do you interpret your job?
Right. Honestly, I don't know if any training prior to could have prepared me other than just getting there and start doing the job. Because until you're actually there in front of the general and briefing him at a cub and you're the one and only legal advisor and they're just like, Legad, I need advice on, you know, this issue, and you don't know what's coming and they just call you on the spot. So it's hard to really, you know, prepare for that. I will say that we did have on our legal officer qualification training, they do run us through a number of scenarios that were somewhat akin, and I would say they were quite helpful in preparing that, where we were just given a problem set, essentially, and then you had a short amount of time to go and brief a pretend commander on a subject matter. So whether it was an ROE or something. So we had a number of stands, as we call it, during our operational law phase. So I kind of reflected on that a few times as I'm running with my notepad in front of the general, not knowing what's coming my way.
Sure.
You know, so, but yeah, the biggest thing was just, you know, kind of staying calm, applying what you know. And if you don't know the answer, just say, I'll get back to you and I'll have to look that up and, you know, do your best to figure out the answer. So.
Yeah, I mean, that is a great point too. The idea that you can prepare for the job, but you can't really know exactly how to respond to the job when the moment arises. And so I think it's important to build on other people's experiences when it comes to that. I think the U.S.'s former Secretary of Defense used to say, your own experiences are never enough to get you through something, you know, I'm paraphrasing. And so I think it's so important to meet people who have gone out there and done it, the thing, and learn from their experiences. So with that being said, what advice would you give to somebody who's there right now doing that job or who's headed to that job right now?
I would tell them to give me a call. One of the things that I found very helpful was actually reaching out to LEGADs who I knew had done that same operation and just getting a sense of the day-to-day, you know, what to expect. Anything from, you know, what's the gym like? What's the weather like to, you know, what were your hours? Mm-hmm. You know, what can I expect? The type of legal issues. And of course, you know, every operation is going to be slightly different, but I found that very helpful just kind of trying to wrap my head around what I was getting myself into. So.
Yeah, that's super helpful. When you left there, you went on and did something else that's pretty cool. RIMPAC. What is RIMPAC? What do LEGADs do at RIMPAC?
Right. So RIMPAC, or Rim of the Pacific Exercise, is the world's largest international maritime warfare exercise. There was 26 countries that participated. It's based out of Pearl Harbor. So
there are worse places.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And 6 weeks in Hawaii. I don't think any Canadian's going to complain about that. So that part was fantastic, but it was so interesting getting to work with lawyers from around the world and work in that coalition environment.
Yeah, so I have done RIMPAC a couple years ago, and well, here's a shout out to Canada, because when I got our ship kind of got plugged in the very last second to go and do this. Another ship got tasked to go somewhere else. We were there to fill in last minute. And all I knew was go to Pearl Harbor. So we go to Pearl Harbor, and I was the navigator at the time. So I found Pearl Harbor, hooray. And then we pulled into port, and my first job was figure out what happens next. And so I literally walked right next door. We were berthed right alongside a Canadian ship, went and saw the navigator and said, "Hey bud, do you know what's going on?" And oh my gosh, so friendly, so helpful, gave me everything I need. And as we're doing this, I hear a sound over the speakers internally on the ship. And I go, "What is that sound?" And he goes, "It's beer call." And I thought, you guys have beer on the ship? Most people in other countries will listen to this and go like, "What's this guy talking about? Of course there's beer on the ship." In America, we do not have beer on the ship. And so I heard this and I was pretty excited. So I got to enjoy the lovely hospitality of the Canadians at RIMPAC. It was wonderful. But all that story is to say, I hadn't know RIMPAC from the perspective of somebody on a ship. I am not at all familiar with from the perspective of the legal advisors. So can you kind of walk me through what it is, what kind of wargaming problems that you're sitting in and involved in?
Right. So I guess I'll just say we started with a legal symposium at the very beginning of RIMPAC, which was really helpful because we got, I think there was, I'm not even sure how many lawyers we were, maybe 30, 40 lawyers had shown up from around the world to participate in this. And so we ran through a number of scenarios, obviously maritime law, law of armed conflict type scenarios that we could expect to be dealing with during the exercise. And then we were each tasked to a specific role. So my role was the Deputy Judge Advocate General of the Combined Forces Maritime Component Command. But other lawyers, and so in that particular section, we were 8 lawyers. And then we also had lawyers who were advising the CAOC, which is the Combined Air Operations Center. And then we also had more lawyers who were out with the actual task force, so on a specific ship. So there was numerous roles that you could potentially do as a legal advisor. So for myself, I was working out of the Pacific Warfighting Center over on Ford Island. And
lovely place to be.
It's beautiful when you're outside, but inside it's a secure operational zone. So no cell phones, no internet, no windows. So
you knew you were
in Hawaii, but you kind of forgot about it sometimes after 10 hours in the old Pacific Warfighting Center. But it was really interesting. My team alone, we had lawyers from New Zealand, Australia, Canada, the United States. So working in a coalition environment, we had the actual CIFMIC, so the commander of CIFMIC was an Australian. So we had integrated teams in all the different various trades that would make up the coalition forces. So our typical day-to-day, there was a lot of briefs and working groups that we would go to. So some common issues were coming up was our rules of engagement and how to apply different rules, say, pertaining to self-defense, because a lot of different countries have different perspectives on what you can do. So it was really interesting kind of just working out, okay, well, how would Canada view this issue versus how would the US? And yet we're all working as a coalition and have to advise the same commander. So finding that common ground and kind of getting to a point where we're all like, okay, all our countries are, you know, comfortable with this. But of course, everybody has national caveats and, you know, our ship can do this. Oh, yeah. And yeah, so that made it really interesting. But I think overall, you have a bunch of like-minded countries coming together to work together. And ultimately, we'd get on the same page pretty quick. So,
yeah, I'll just kind of describe for listeners. I think most people would be familiar with what rules of engagement are, what ROE is. But for those who aren't, it is simply a set of regulations that a force has imposed on itself to make sure that they don't violate the law or to make sure that there's good command and control of the forces. And so the legal advisor's role, Heidi, I mean, please step in if you feel like I mischaracterized something. The legal advisor's role to say, you know, how do we impose the law onto these to make sure we're not violating international humanitarian law or any other applicable laws that are incumbent upon the force to observe? Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. And with that, you know, we have our rules of engagement, our orders. We had one of the things that we participated in daily was the target validation board. So when we're dealing with targeting, we're looking at military objectives and making sure that, you know, things that we're considering targeting as a lawful, you know, military objective, fits within our rules of engagement and is also, you know, compliant with international law. So that was very interesting to sit on those boards. It's something I haven't done in a real life operation, but certainly having the experience doing that at RIMPAC, you know, you want to do it on an exercise before you go and do it in real life. I definitely would say that. So that was really invaluable experience for me.
Absolutely. And I will make a plug too for the NATO school. Oberammergau does some really good targeting courses for legal advisors that are in NATO military. So if you have an opportunity or have a desire, I highly recommend you reach out to NSO and see if you can participate in that. And also that you participate in RIMPAC or exercises like it. It's a really, really cool experience. And you get to work with a lot of other people. I want to jump back to something you said earlier about national caveats, because this is something that I found so interesting in doing these courses like the down in Oberammergau or in San Remo about naval law and reconciling, really for me for the first time, America's perspective of ROE and what the law allows and reconciling that with our partners in other nations. And so can you talk a little bit about what that experience was like?
Well, specifically for RIMPAC, that became a bit of a challenging task because we had to kind of try and compile 26 countries' national caveats and try and map them out so that when we were advising the task force of what they could do and what they couldn't do, we had to look at a specific mission and be like, okay, well, we have a Canadian ship, you know, here. Can they engage the force, or is this something that we need to ask, you know, an American ship to do because they don't have a national caveat on that particular aspect of the ROE? So, you know, we did our best to try and, you know, certainly not exclude any nations, but you had certain nations that were, you know, such as Japan, who has a very different approach and is more their defense force. And so depending on the type of tasking, and as we're playing out this scenario, you kind of had to be cognizant of what they were able to do. And if they were in your task force, how are we going to approach this? So the national caveats, I mean, obviously they are absolutely essential, but we had our policy advisor with us, which was quite interesting because they actually are kind of a bit of the liaison point for at least from the Canadian perspective in terms of what national caveats we have. And, you know, if we were going to go back to, say, the government of Canada, because ultimately it's fed through the government what our national caveats are going to be and why. So it was really instrumental having our POLAD with us to kind of help us work through that. But maybe in the future, they'll send some more policy advisors to help some other countries navigate that area.
Yeah. And that's a great point too, because, and I hope I didn't confuse anyone or mischaracterize this, because national caveats are not differing interpretations of the law. As, you know, they're policy decisions that are made by these foreign governments that say, even if international law allows us to do this, we're going to put additional impositions on whether or not our forces are going to do this in a joint or coalition right. environment. So I think it's important to make that distinction between just because there's a different national caveat on this doesn't mean that then, you know, Denmark's interpretation of the law is different or that we disagree over whether or not international law allows us to do that. We're just saying that we're not going to do it unless these other criteria are met. Is that a good way to characterize caveats?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And then I think ROE, kind of the same thing goes as well. It's not, this isn't a lawyer saying, no, you know, these are the only situations that you can engage another force. That is a commander's decision to put those ROE in there. And the legal advisor's role in that is just to say, yep, this meets IHL requirements as well. Is that
right?
Are we on the same page?
Absolutely. You know, we're given our arcs of fire and the commander will take the mission and say, okay, I've been given X, Y, and Z for ROE, but for this specific mission, we only need X and Y. So sometimes, you know, it will narrow down and it will be the commander's discretion. But of course, they can never implement ROE that's bigger than what has actually been authorized. So, you know, you can narrow it down, but you can't expand on it. So,
yeah. And you brought up a good point about targeting too, and I hope we do a separate episode on it altogether. But I think the same kind of principle applies. You know, the legal advisor is one piece in that puzzle of advising the commander from a legal perspective on the legal risk involved in that targeting decision. There's other advisors, policy advisors, or political advisors, cultural advisors that are part of that process. And it is by no means the lawyer's call as to whether or not that airstrike is made or that shot is fired. So if there's any misconception out there, that's not how it is supposed to work.
Yeah. Key to our, the legal advisor is the advisor. Yes. We advise. We're not ultimately making the decisions. So.
And that, you know, that brings up another interesting question too, just interpersonal relationships between the legal advisor and the commander. You're currently a legal advisor at JTF Pacific, and I'm not really asking you to comment on your relationship with the commander of that, but that's just to point out you've been in these war games, also operationally had to advise commanders. Do you have any advice or things that you advice that you received that you found helpful when dealing interpersonally with the people that you are advising?
I think it's definitely instrumental to your relationship to just try and get that meet and greet and develop a bit of a personal relationship. Because once you're actually dealing with issues and you understand them as a person, it's a lot easier to advise them. Because, you know, somebody who's standing in front of a group at a Cub and, you know, without having that background and really understanding their mannerisms, how they're speaking to you, you know, you could kind of misinterpret some of the cues. So I found it really helpful just getting to know, you know, as much as you can, just knowing a bit about people's families and where they come from and just a bit of their background. And it just made it easier to have a bit of an interpersonal relationship to ultimately be able to advise them. And then they know where you're coming from. And ultimately it really helped that relationship.
Yeah. I mean, it seems so simple, but that's terrific advice. You don't want the first interaction you have with someone that you're advising to be in a crisis where they need legal advice, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You want to be able to tailor how you deliver that to what you know about the person who's receiving it. That's super helpful. So I mentioned JTF Pacific just a moment ago. We kind of glossed over what it is. What is it? Where is it? How does the League Ad fit into this piece of the pie?
Right. So JTFP stands for Joint Task Force Pacific. So essentially, we respond to all domestic operations. So anything from hypothetically the defense of Canada to civil support operations. So we have six JTFs across Canada, and we all report up to our higher headquarters, which is the Canadian Joint Operations Center. And so essentially we do a lot of wargaming. We do a lot of contingency planning and tabletop exercises, kind of preparing for hopefully not the inevitable, but we have a lot of plans. But a lot of the work we've done in recent years has been assisting the provincial government with natural disasters. So essentially, the military can be called out. We get what we call a request for assistance. Once the province and the government has exhausted all their resources and they're like, okay, there's a major flood, we just can't handle this with the resources we have, they'll put a request for assistance through the government channels, and ultimately the CAF will respond. So when those requests for assistance come in, it's JTFP for our area of operation who is going to be ultimately responding to these. So the commander of MARPAC, so the whole Pacific Fleet, is also the commander of Joint Task Force Pacific. So he kind of wears two hats. He's also the SAR commander, so I guess he can say he wears three hats.
Wow.
So depending on what's happening, so if it's a, you know, search and rescue operation, then he's the SAR commander, so I'll advise on that aspect of it. But as the legal advisor, when these requests for assistance come in, certainly I play a role in reviewing those. Ultimately, it's a top-down. Usually we get our orders from CJOC, and then we'll implement our tactical level orders. So I'll be involved in drafting those, making sure that what our plan to support is in line with the request for assistance, and that we stay within kind of the actual request and not, you know, when they call out the military, kind of go outside of those parameters. So that's a large part of what I advise on. But of course, once we put troops on the ground, there's a number of issues, you know, whether it's police, jurisdiction, personnel issues, again, comes contracts, land use agreements, all of those types of things. So I will be the first one they call when there's issues with any of those things. So,
yeah, contracts, land use agreements. This is all sounds like a lot of, I'm having flashbacks to the legal advisor course days.
No, not my favorite aspect, but I mean, I work out of once we do get a call, we stand up our battle watch center and we all have our desks. So I go and we'll actually sit down and be with the team there and advise as required. So
that raises a question for me too. Canadian Navy or Canadian Armed Forces, is this include or is it different from the Coast Guard or what we consider Coast Guard forces?
Yeah, so they're totally separate. So okay. Our Coast Guard actually falls under the Department of Fisheries and Oceans in Canada, and whereas we have the Department of National Defense. So we are completely separate government, federal government departments. And they're not part of the armed force. Like I believe your Coast Guard is, you know, part of the armed force. That is totally separate for us.
Okay, interesting. And so I'm imagining that the Coast Guard then is also getting these requests for support from the provincial government as well during these types of natural disasters. Is that right? Or they just don't have the capacity to deal with that kind of thing. That's your job.
No, you're totally correct. So okay. We have the Government Operations Center. And so this is the Federal Government Operations Center in Ottawa. And when disasters come and they need all the different departments, they'll call up people from various departments to assist. And we have the whole of government approach, as we call it. And so there will be actually representatives from all the different federal governments who might, you know, be of assistance, depending on what the actual disaster is. So certainly the Coast Guard will have a place to, and we work frequently with them. So with our search and rescue response, for instance, if it's maritime, it's the Coast Guard. If it's aeronautic, the military has the primary. And so oftentimes there's some interplay of who's going to respond. And so we work closely with them. And we actually have the Marine Security Operations Center called the MSOC. And this is located in MARPAC, but we have representatives from various federal government departments. And the whole idea behind that is that we share information. And when something comes that is going to be possibly a national level emergency, then all the key players already know about it. They've already talked about it. And then they can feed information directly to our Government Operations Center in Ottawa. And then they'll ultimately decide who's going to be the lead department and who's going to be the supporting. And then we all work together.
Well, I mean, it sounds so simple in theory.
On paper,
I'm sure it's very hectic when it actually happens, but you make it sound so well organized and tidy. So that's what you're doing at JTF Pacific right now, JTFP right now. How long do you have left there? And then you go somewhere else? Is that, do you do it in tours a couple years at a time? Is that how it works in Canada?
So typically a posting will be 3 to 5 years. So I've been with the AJAG Pacific office since 2015, but as I was getting trained as a legal officer, I wasn't actually posted to a billet until I hit my occupational functional point. And that was 2018 for me. So I've technically been posted now in my current position for 4 years. So I know I'm coming up on the end of my tenure here, so I think I'm likely to get posted this year. So
okay, and you don't know yet where that'll be.
I've actually asked to go to CJOC, so I really like the operational law, and being the advisor to JTFP, our higher headquarters is CJOC. So if I could get a position at that's in Ottawa. Okay. So if I could get a position for me, that, you know, would be a perfect transition because I understand the business of what we're doing at the tactical level and advised. So to work at the higher headquarters, I think it would be a well-suited position for me. So if any of my chain of commands are listening to this, hopefully they'll take me up on this pitch, but we'll see.
It's on the internet. It has to happen.
I'm going to end up in mid-law.
That's right. They'll put you on the East Coast somewhere terrible.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding, Canada. We love your East Coast. So I hope that your new posting does not interfere with your attendance at the Conference on Operational Maritime Law 2023, which will be hosted in Victoria, thanks in large part to your hard work. Can you tell us a little bit about Victoria and give us your pitch? Come to Victoria.
Okay, well, Victoria is my hometown, so I'm completely biased when I'm going to talk about it, but it's the capital of British Columbia. It's a small city, less than 500,000 people, and it's beautiful. It's right on the harbor. It's also home to our Pacific Fleet. So I believe the intent will be to host a conference on CFB Esquimalt. And in one of our messes that we have, they're both located right on the ocean, have amazing views. So no matter what the subject matter is, worst case, look out the window and you'll be pleasantly, you'll be pleased in what you see, I hope. But Victoria just offers so much in terms of tourism activities. If you're an outdoor enthusiast, this is definitely a great place to be. And I can't wait. I'm really hoping that if I'm posted, there's a chance I still might be here. So I will be able to attend regardless. So yeah, we're looking forward to having you. There's certainly plans underway. And so we're working with our visits and protocol section. And everybody's really excited to have host this conference.
Well, I know I am so excited to get back to my home in Puget Sound. And we promise not to lock you down like they do on Fort Island without sunlight. You'll be able to, like Heidi said, we'll be able to look outside and see what's going on out there. Highly recommend. I am not at all enthusiastic about flying to the opposite side of the world, but I know I will be very happy once I get there. Heidi, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you very much, James. It's been a pleasure.
The COE CSW is a leading NATO think and do tank focused on enhancing military capabilities to contend with the security challenges posed in the worlds confined in shallow waters. As a reminder, the views expressed in this podcast are solely the speaker's own and do not reflect the positions of NATO, the COE CSW, or any of the institutions to which the participants belong.